Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for June the 6th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of some public hearings and work sessions. I apologize in advance. This agenda is moving around as we are awaiting additional information. I'm told at this point that Senate Bill 693 will be a public hearing only at this point, and contrary to the first agenda that was released, House Bill 2638 will be a public hearing only. So we're going to start with House Bill 2638. With that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2638 and ask Mr. Terpening to introduce us to the subject. Sure. I got you up first, Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was a little concerned how you were starting out there. We're gathered here today. I don't hear that from very many chairs, Madam Chair. But anyways, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Andy Olson.
Representative Olson, may I ask our professional staff to just introduce the subject matter?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, House Bill 2638 establishes a certification program for ignition interlock devices, service centers, and technicians that includes certification, inspection, criminal background checks for installers, and tracking and follow-up of negative IID reports. This program is to be operated by the Oregon Department of Transportation for the 17-19 biennium with a program operative date of July 1, 2018, and then transfer the program to Oregon State Police on July 1, 2019. The measure takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment of the 2017 legislature. The measure also establishes the Ignition Interlock Device Management Fund. This fund allows for, in addition to monies from the certification program, other monies deposited into the fund from any source. The measure does stipulate that the fees for establishment of application, issuance, and renewal of certificates are required to cover the cost of the certification program. The certification fee and the amount of revenue that will be needed to fund the program is indeterminate at this time. According to ODOT, as of 2016, there were 17 approved IID vendors and 177 installation centers in Oregon, although DMV has since discontinued maintaining that list. The Transportation Safety Division within ODOT anticipates the need for three full-time positions to implement and administer this program. The cost of those positions is around $386,000 of other funds. It is assumed that until some of the certification fee revenue would come in, that they would use funds from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration impaired driving grant funds to for the initial costs of setting up the program. As far as the transfer to OSP in the 1921 biennium, OSP has some different assumptions on how they would administer the program. They would do their model similar to the program operated by the Washington State Patrol. This would include five permanent full-time positions, three troopers, one sergeant, and one administrative staff with services and supplies and four vehicles. Total cost for the program under OSP in 1921 would be $1.8 million of other funds.
Okay, thank you very kindly. Just as a preparatory remark, I'll say that one of the reasons that this moved to a public hearing only at this juncture was my concern about the discrepancies in the fiscals, and I hope that testimony today will help address that question. But when I noticed the substantial differential, I raised it. So with that, welcome, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Once again, my name is Andy Olson, state representative from the Albany area. And Senator Monroe, this is one of those bills that's kind of up in your alley. So, this is one of those issues that we have had serious concern about over the last several years. How do we get there with really having some control for those that are DUI offenders and holding them accountable as it applies toward the ignition interlock device? Senator, or actually Representative Mitch Greenlick and I, we talked about this a couple of years ago, and to a point where he was very interested in wanting to tag along on this whole issue. So last year, we put together a work group, and I've submitted a letter that's on OLIS to you for testimony, but I'm not going to go through all of that with you. I'm going to just kind of share a little nuts and bolts on this thing. In the work group, we had members from ODOT, from DOJ, we have members from the DA's Association, OCDLA, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association was present, and we had two members that retired from Washington State Patrol as well, and former Captain Rob Reichert is here with me right now. They're here because they get a chance to really share what they have been doing over the last several years and have found some very good process to make this work within their agency, WSP. But let me just read a couple little pieces here on this for you, and then I'm going to just kind of stop for a moment and let Rob take over. House Bill 2638 changes the game in Oregon as it relates to the ignition interlock device, or IID. This measure is an important step in the fight against DUI offender accountability. Currently, Oregon's IID laws lack oversight to protect the public from impaired drivers. DUI offenders in the process of adjudication and treatment are also at risk from dishonest vendors and installers that take advantage of them due to non-existence of standards or accountability. Only 35% of DUI offenders actually install an IID in their vehicles. That means that 65% of DUI offenders do not comply with installation. As a result, treatment programs are not effective and causes additional oversight with the courts, district attorneys, and parole and probation.
Representative, may I interrupt you and ask, how do we know these numbers, that 65% flaunt the directive to put an interlock device in? How do we know that? That's a startlingly high number.
Those are numbers that I took from information that MAD themselves had provided. Okay. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers.
Thank you.
For the state. And then I'm just going to kind of share here that House Bill 2638 is the product of the interim group, like I had mentioned to you, and who was all involved with that, and then also with where Washington State Patrol was extremely involved in coming down and visiting with us and working through this whole process over the next several months of last year. So I think... as you can see, the bill itself, with the A engrossed version, anyways, does meet some of the issues that ODOT needed to have and recommendations on an operative date pushed out to give them a little bit more opportunity. It does eventually hand off to Oregon State Police, so it follows a real similar model of what WSP has done. One of the reasons that we really had the conversation initially with this was not just the idea of holding accountable the DUI offenders and also to try to bring some consistency across the board, but also there are some of those offenders out there that have been arrested for DUI three different times. They end up getting revoked for their driver's license for 10 years, that they had no opportunity in order to get a hardship license until their 10 years are up. If, in fact, we prove over the next several years that as we implement this program that it's effective, then those folks might have an opportunity, those DUI offenders may have an opportunity to come back and apply for hardship license maybe halfway through their 10-year period as long as they use an IID and that the IID program itself is extremely effective. So that was some of the conversation, too, that we'd had.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions for Representative Olson?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So, Representative Olson, first of all, thanks for your testimony. And is the effectiveness of the IID program coupled with the fact that they're done by certified installers, or is that not an issue?
We do have, I think probably... Amy, are you in a position to answer that with the certification part?
The chair would be happy to have ODOT come forward. Amy Joyce. identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I apologize. Could you repeat the question, please?
So I'm wondering if the effectiveness of the IID program is linked to the fact that they're installed by certified installers, or maybe I'm not understanding the thing. Are they always installed by certified installers, or?
Chair Johnson and Representative Nierman, under the current system, there's no certification of installers. The only thing that's certified right now is the device itself. It has to be a particular kind of technology. There has to be a camera. That's what this bill is trying to fix, is there's no certification of installers or vendors or the people working in this system.
So then I'll modify my question then. So this bill's introducing a certification of devices then. So is there a link between the certification of the devices and the effectiveness of the IIDs?
Chair Johnson and Representative Nierman, I apologize if I misspoke. Devices currently they have to be certified. They have to be a particular, so that is currently existing law, and DMV actually does that. What the bill proposes to do then is to have a certification process for those installers. So you have to do any number of things that would be set up in rule by the Department of Transportation under our safety division to have a certified installer and not just anybody being able to install this thing, calibrate it, take money under the table, whatever is going on.
Good. Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Joyce, why don't you remain with us? There may be other questions. And have you concluded your testimony?
I am.
Okay. Forgive me, I didn't hear your rank, but welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself.
My name is Rob Reichert, and I'm a retired commander for the Washington State Patrol, one of the founders of the program when it first started. And thank you, Madam Chair.
I think we're going to stand at ease for just a second until this distraction is resolved. Again, invite the retired commander's introduction and testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for having me. I wasn't planning on speaking, however. I told Rep. Olson that I would sure step in and answer any questions since I was one of the founders in Washington State to start that program. When I started that program, it came to me in a little brown box, and the chief said, it's now your program. So we started that from the ground up, and some of the things that have already been discussed is a great opportunity to strengthen this law. And the reason, you know, as far as ignition airlock companies, they actually want this standardized program. They want this monitoring of the ignition airlock program because there's very specific calibrations and services that need to take place on a monthly basis. Because if you do not calibrate that device correctly, that gives an opportunity for that driver to actually still drink and drive if they're not calibrated correctly, as we found out in Washington State. There also needs to be a 24-hour helpline for all ignition airlock companies, because you have your clients out there, you have your customers out there, you have your citizens of Oregon out there, and they get stuck out, you know, in Eastern Oregon where there is no nothing. You want to make sure that they have assistance out there and they have a shop that they can actually go to. I will tell you that, and I'll just speak briefly, and then I'm really here for questions. As far as fiscally, when I started that program, there was nothing. And what I heard as far as money, and what I heard is that our Traffic Safety Commission, our government office, they actually helped us for the first year. And then after that, that's when we started to gain money from the certification of the shop. Money from the technicians. The technicians have to be have a criminal background investigation before they are hired by each individual manufacturer. They also have to, their device has to be inspected by the Washington State Patrol, and it's gone over within our breath test section. So us folks, that's what I commanded, the evidentiary breath test section, is that we went over those devices to ensure that they were accurate and that the fuel cell was correct. We used to use a T-cell. We don't do that anymore because you can. There's some avoidance issues there and circumventions issue. However, I will get back to the fiscal part of it, is that after we started the program, there are many fees that take place that actually started to pay for the three troopers and the sergeant and the administrative staff. I never had to go back to the legislature and ask for any funds to fund that program. It is and was self-sustaining at that time.
If I could interrupt and ask a question, does it have to be sworn personnel? Could an ODOT employee be adequately trained to do the inspection? What I'm worried about is that, not unlike Washington from time to time, we're right now in a budget problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out what your experience in Washington was. I think by everybody's agreement, the Washington program is doing well, and it is achieving the ends of the bill, which is to stop dangerous driving. But if you would you describe why it would have to be sworn personnel as opposed to highly trained ODOT employees?
I can. What we did, and I think this is very important for the strength of the program, what we did is I would send out troopers myself, and we would go and knock on doors of citizens of Washington State. There was no enforcement action that we could take. However, we would knock on the door and say, do you have an ignition interlock in your vehicle? Either say yes or no, and if they didn't have it in there, we would then report that to DOL, and there were even times where we would set up an operation to catch that person driving, and that happened quite often. And I will tell you, as law enforcement, when we went to these houses, we were going to the bad neighborhoods, the gang neighborhoods. There were times when we had to back out, and I'm just going, geez, I'm going to retire in a while. I'm not going into this gang house just for an ignition interlock at this point. So there was a commission piece to that that assisted the state of Washington in building that program. And the funny thing is the media got a hold of that, and the citizens of Washington State got a hold of that information and said, you know what? The state troopers are serious about impaired driving. And we, you know, and so that was in the media. And the next thing we know, we had people calling up and saying, I need to get my ignition interlock in right away. So there was a piece to that. And again, I'll reiterate that that program was self-sustaining as far as the commission people are expensive. I agree. However, it paid for the cars. It paid for the troopers, their salaries, their benefits, and overtime. There was nothing out of that. I had to go back to the legislature for any more funds.
I got a little confused, though. Was there some bridge funding that got you to a point where the fees kicked in?
Yes. Actually, I got grant money from the Traffic Safety Commission in Washington State, the Highway Government Office. And yes, they started us off for about a year. And then after that, it was self-sustaining because those funds, when people start installing, there are numerous funds that take place. When they get installed, it's $10 back to the Washington State Patrol every month. There's a $5 fee back to the Washington State Patrol. Every time a new interlock device comes into the state and they apply to be a company in the state, that's $2,500. It's quite extensive. And each technician has to be certified once a year. So that's $100. And then after that, it's $50. You know, there's several fees on top of that that the companies have to pay. That comes from the ignition interlock companies. All those fees.
Colleagues.
And from the, actually, sorry, and from the offenders.
Colleagues, any questions? Representative Rudin.
Thank you. I just don't know the appropriate time, but these devices could, I'm not saying this would be a good idea, but could your spouse or your whatever breathe into the device for you?
They can, however, they're allowed to drive, of course. The family members are allowed to drive that ignition interlocked vehicle. You know, there's nothing saying that. However, as soon as you reach over and have your wife blow while you're driving, yes, that is a circumvention in the state of Washington, and you cannot do that. That is a crime.
And if I may, Chair, Chair Johnson and Representative Reardon, so the current rules to be a certified device in Oregon is it's got a camera right. feature to it, so when you blow into the device, it's clicking that picture, and if
here we go.
I show up,
you don't
on
look
his,
like an identical twin to your wife.
Right. So there's a way to catch people who okay. try to circumvent.
Pretty cool. Any other questions? I have one, Commander, if you don't mind. Did you find when the fees were imposed that there was a chilling effect on installers or vendors?
No, okay. Not at all.
And then one for Ms. Joyce. If you are starting this program, you, ODOT, are starting this program with federal funds, what would preclude ODOT from seeking those federal funds and passing them through? What I'm to OSP.
Chair Johnson, and I might throw a lifeline to Dan Estes, who's the current impaired driving program manager at our safety division, but I think the way the fiscal is constructed right now and the plan would be for those federal funds to start, to get the startup going for the program, I think on the order of $200,000, $300,000 of federal funds that are dedicated to impaired driving tasks, so this qualifies. In term, is your question then for going forward, can we pass that money through to OSP to keep the fees
correct
down?
Correct, until the fees get going, because what I'm worried about is you're starting the program with these federal funds. You then dump it over onto OSP. OSP is using troopers, and they cost a lot of money, and they're worth every dime. But I want to try to figure out how this doesn't become a burden on OSP. Our guest from Washington has already made the case why it's important to use sworn personnel. It has an incentivizing effect. And so I'm trying to figure out why, until this is completely fee-sustained, ODOT couldn't provide federal pass-through money out of the safety program to not have OSP have to take a hit or to come back and beg for general fund until that bridge was completely built.
So, Chair, I'm going to, if Dan Estes could come up and join me, he's the current program manager and is in charge of distributing those funds, but I think contemplated in our fiscal is the idea that if additional time was needed for the bridge, as you indicated, that would be a possibility.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Estes. I'm ODOT's impaired driving program manager. This would, the question about bridge financing, the goal of this bill would be to make sure that the program is self-funded before it ever transfers to OSP. So OSP would never be taking any kind of fiscal hit. We do have quite a bit of discretion in how we use our federal funds for impaired driving. This particular project would likely be funded out of the NHTSA funds, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Their particular grant fund is 164AL, reserved for alcohol-only projects, which an ignition interlock device would be considered alcohol-only. I think there always would be an opportunity to continue that funding until the program became self-sustaining, but I think it's the goal of everybody here that we wouldn't transfer that program over in the 18 months that we have it. We would make sure that it is self-sustaining before it ever lands in OSP's lap.
And I'm going to ask the professional staff if we can assure that the four corners of the page, the language in the bill, would create that certainty for OSP. If you don't mind, Ms. Joyce and Mr. Rickert, I'm going to excuse you and ask the other two witnesses that have signed up from OSP to come forward. You're more than welcome to stay, Mr. Estes. We may have more questions for
you. I would
be
happy to.
Again, my goal here is to try to not disadvantage OSP financially and to be able to utilize this very excellent program, but not suck troopers off the road or damage an agency that's already picked up an awful lot of assignments. By executive order, they're doing background checks. I think you're doing boxing now. And for some of us who are sorry there aren't more troopers on the road, it's a concern. So would you please identify yourselves and give your testimony?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Bill Fugate. I'm the legislative coordinator for the state police. And I'm here today just to express to you that we are neutral on this, but just to mention that this House Bill 2638 does fall in line with one of our core missions of transportation safety. As you know, we target our enforcement efforts on the road on the five driving behaviors that lead to serious injury and fatal crashes. We use the acronym SOLID: speed, occupant safety, lane usage, impaired driving, and distracted driving. So this bill, with the impaired driving element, would also be in alignment with our mission to reduce those type of deaths and serious injury crashes on the highways. So today, I'm here to answer your questions about that, but also before we go on, I'd like to introduce Captain Bloom. She was the one that we prepared for the fiscal impact on the numbers that we had there, with a high number there. So if she could proceed.
Thank you very much. Welcome, yes. Captain Bloom.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Bloom, and I am Captain of the Oregon State Police Patrol Division. I am here today speaking on this bill because if it were to pass, the IID program would be supervised by me in the Patrol Division. I will now give a short overview of OSP's fiscal impact estimates. Based on the recommendation that came out of the bipartisan interim work group that Representative Olson talked about previously on the internet, on the IID, it was our understanding that the intent of this bill was for OSP to base our model on a similar program operated by Washington State Police, which you've already heard about. Taking that into consideration, we anticipated the eventual need for 5 permanent full-time positions dedicated to the IID oversight upon transfer to OSP in July of 2019. This would mirror the WSP model, which includes 3 troopers, 1 sergeant, and an administrative staff at a total cost of just over $1.8 million, other funds for the 2019-21 biennium. The 2019-21 budget cycle estimates include 4 vehicles, service and supplies, and other program startup costs. Cost estimates for the subsequent biennium are a little bit lower, estimated at just under $1.75 million for the 21-23 biennium. So at this time, I myself and Captain Fugate would be willing to take any questions that you may have.
Colleagues, any questions? Either one of you, if you heard ODOT's testimony, if there was a mechanism to keep the federal funds flowing as a pass-through from ODOT to OSP until we demonstrated that fee revenue could cover the cost of these 5 additional FTE, would that be acceptable to you and commensurate with the work group recommendations?
If I may, Madam Chair and members of the committee, absolutely. You know, like I said, this is along our mission of transportation safety. And, you know, more than happy to take on this program. And we do also believe in our organization that sworn presence really will have the teeth in the enforcement and prevention of impaired driving or tampering with those kind of devices. And just like Washington is a testament to that.
One other question for either one of you or, frankly, any of the other witnesses, Representative Olson. Was the work group completely aligned in their recommendation? Are there any DOJ issues that we haven't heard, any ODOT issues? Is this boiled down now to a money issue, the differential between the cost of ODOT doing it with federal funds and you all having to absorb this additional cost, given that it's sworn personnel, when the program transfers?
I would definitely have to defer to Representative Olson or people that were on.
Oh, Representative Olson just fled the jurisdiction.
I don't know if anyone else.
So I'm going to invite Ms. Joyce or Mr. Estes to come up and see if, were you part of the work group?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, come forward, please.
I was looking around for him.
As soon as you turn around, out of here.
Again, I'm Dan Estes, ODOT's Impaired Driving Program Manager. I did participate in the work group, and I do not believe there were any other outstanding issues from any of the various agencies or entities involved. Prosecutors were involved, DOJ was involved, ODOT, OSP, our legislative leaders, Representatives Green, Lincoln, Olson, the courts were involved, DMV was involved.
Defense attorneys, DAs, everybody smiling?
I'm not sure if I've ever heard a defense attorney smile, ma'am. But
point is taken.
They participated fully, and actually, if I may, this is a critical step and revolved around a lot of the discussions we had with the defense attorneys. Right now, you folks are considering a lot of legislation that deal with hardship permits and hard suspensions and probationary licenses and things like that. We've always been somewhat cautious about that, because of the gaping hole we have in our ignition interlock device system, there is not that accountability with the system that we have now, and we've always tried to hold off on some of those conversations because, you know, you patch the hole in the bucket before you fill it up with water. And that's kind of what we're doing here. We're making sure that our IID system is as robust as possible, and that way we can have those conversations about, you know, hardship permits and things like that. That was really the focus for the defense attorneys as part of all this, but they're also very supportive because these are their clients. These are their clients that have to have these devices. So you want them to be treated as fairly as possible in the system. They need to be able to have that 24-hour contact number. They need to be able to access the providers. They need to be spaced around the state in a way that's convenient for them. All of this revolves around accountability and making sure the people that have IIDs are using them effectively.
Okay, I'm going to ask Captain Bloom to step back, and I'm going to ask Ms. Joyce to come up one more time. Because if we're narrowing in on a solution here, I don't want to be doing this without ODOT saying okie dokie. Or words to that effect.
Senator Johnson, okie dokie.
Okay. So you think that you could do this until we have a demonstration that fee revenue is completely supporting the five OSP sworn folks?
Okie dokie.
Yes.
We agree. Sounds like we got okie dokies all around. Captain Fugate, does that give you confidence?
Absolutely. You know, partners. We're proud of our partners with ODOT and getting impaired drivers off the road. So if they're good to go with it, we support that and are honored to take on the program.
All right. We had one other person sign up, Mr. Fralick, Brad Fralick. Would you like to come forward and testify? You gentlemen can escape if you'd like. Probably shouldn't say that to a trooper. Mr. Fralick, welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Brad Fralick, and I'm with the Coalition of Ignition Lock Manufacturers. We've also submitted written testimony. I was just kind of came here to answer any questions, but I would like to say that we are fully in support of this. We represent five of the largest ignition lock companies, representing about 75% of the market nationwide. We think it is very, very important that you have these standards. Historically, Oregon has not had those standards, so they've had some of the problems with basically, I hate to use the term, but fly-by-night providers coming in, not providing the proper services, and then, you know, leaving clients holding the bag. We think that there needs to be accountability. There has to be accountability. And, you know, we absolutely applaud using Washington State as a model. My job is Director of Government Relations, and in my efforts, we are copying Washington State all across the country. There was a legislation very similar to this one that just passed and was signed into law by the governor of Arizona this session. There's similar language in the state of Massachusetts going forth right now. There's some language being discussed in the state of California. There's language taken from Washington State being used right now in statute in the state of Tennessee. They are somewhat the, for lack of a better term, the it girl as far as ignition lock programs go. They're not perfect, but they're the closest thing to it. And what the earlier speaker said about having a uniform sworn police officer going out and checking on these people, that is a massive difference. The state of Illinois has a system where what you describe, where you have state employees that are not sworn officers going out and doing inspections and checking with service centers. Illinois is twice the size in population as the state of Washington, but they only have half the number of devices. And this component where the officers are going out and visiting is the reason why. They know that. The word on the street gets around that troopers will come around and will be visiting you, so they do the right thing. They go in and they get the devices.
Could you run that down to Captain Fricate? Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions?
Just one.
Representative Nierman. Representative Reardon. Sorry.
Thank you. Just a late read on the summary here. says they would require providers to have statewide service centers. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, you would have to have a service center network that would cover the entire state. That is an absolutely crucial aspect, because states that don't have it, you tend to get the quote-unquote cherry-picking, where they go into the large metropolitan areas, put a few there, and then they just ignore the rural areas. It's very, very important. Okay. In the state of Arizona, which is a similar list, they put in a provision there that said that you had to have at least one service center in every county in Arizona, and you had to do mobile service from that county. So they were looking at addressing that same issue.
Thank you.
Given that you represent a trade association, is there anything in this bill that advantages or disadvantages certain vendors? Are we leaving the playing field open, or are we doing anything that might cause there to be a closed shop in Oregon?
No, this leaves everything open. Now, you're going to have to meet these more stringent standards.
Yeah.
But it's completely open to everyone.
Okay.
And this is a great mix.
Okay.
You don't want to go where it's single bid and then you lose the service, and you don't want to go to a closed shop.
Cool. Well, I'm going to just take the temperature of the committee. The direction that we're working here is to ask ODOT to provide, through federal highway safety grants, sufficient revenue until the fee revenue kicks in to completely cover OSP's additional cost of sending sworn troopers. Any objection? All right, that's not just a consensus of the group. Anybody in the audience disagree with that direction? Okay, then I'm going to ask the professional staff if we can ask the big co-chairs to adopt amendments that cause this to be, and we should see this bill again up for work session. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2683, and we're going to open a public hearing and work session on SB 357.
375.
God, I'm not tired of anything. 375, relating to posting at roadside rest areas informational materials on human trafficking. And Mr. Hansel, would you like to?
I can do that.
Go down and. I'm going to ask while you're taking your seat to have the professional staff tee us up on where we are. I'm just going to go out in the hall and make sure everything's cool.
Madam Chair and members. Senate Bill 375 seeks to raise awareness of human trafficking by posting informational materials in the restroom stalls of each roadside rest area in Oregon. It establishes a human trafficking awareness fund at the Department of Transportation as well as parks. It authorizes both ODOT and parks to receive gifts and grants to cover the related costs, and this is anticipated to have a minimal fiscal effect.
Well, thank you very much. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator from Senate District 29 in northeastern Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate Bill 375, a bill to allow the placement of posters in rest stop bathrooms. Over the summer, this past summer, I was contacted by a constituent on a different subject matter. But at the end of the phone call, she asked, Senator, when I'm traveling in other states on the East Coast, I can stop in a rest area along the highway. They have posters to combat sex trafficking. However, when I'm in rest stops here in Oregon, we don't have those. Do you know why? I replied to her, I had no idea, but I would find out. Well, we found out not only do we not have any of these kind of posters in restroom areas in Oregon, it's against the law to put them there. My office began to work with various state agencies to create the opportunity to have the sex trafficking posters in rest areas to combat sex and human trafficking. We held a meeting with members of every agency that are involved in the rest areas around the state. Those agencies include Travel Oregon, State Parks, Oregon Travel Experience, Oregon Department of Transportation, as well as the League of Oregon Cities. In addition to these agencies, Kevin Campbell, representing the Chiefs of Police and Sheriffs, Nita Bells, trafficking advocate, and Bob Russell from the Oregon Truckers Association were also present. We begin discussing the issue and attempting to solve this very drastic and insidious activity. Sex trafficking and human trafficking is an epidemic that must be stopped. It is a terrible practice and truly a horror for every city nationwide. The human trafficking crisis has reached the level that in much of the developing world, and Oregon is not beyond its reach. Most sex trafficking occurs at rest stops along the interstates, and the worst rest stop is in Oregon. In fact, the whole West Coast, we were told, the number one sex trafficking is right outside of Wilsonville on I-5. In Oregon alone, the human trafficking hotline received 300 calls in 2016. This was in regards to 72 different human trafficking cases, as such amounted to approximately 646 different victims. Of the female victims, the FBI reports the average age at which they become victims is between the ages of 12 and 14 years. In Senate Bill 375, it allows for the posters to be put in up in rest area bathrooms across the state, not only at the popular interstate highways, but on every roadside rest area managed by the State Department. Both interstate and state highways is crucial in attempting to get this necessary information in front of as many people as we can. We list in the bill three specific provisions for the posters. Posters must include one toll-free hotline number. They must include at least one text message number. And the posters will be in English and translated in the languages most commonly spoken in the state. It should be noted that the state highway funds cannot be used to fund the placement and coordination of the notices. The bill allows for two human trafficking awareness funds to be created, one for the Department of Transportation and the other for the State Parks and Recreation Department. The fund is allowed to receive gifts, grants, and other contributions from both public and private sources. It also has the ability for the legislature to approve funds directly, although this particular bill does not do that. The bill states that ODOT and State Parks and Recreation Department will adopt rules for this program after each agency has received adequate funds to carry out the program. The bill provides the opportunity for ODOT and Parks to work with nonprofit organizations to establish an agreement and allow for nonprofits to post and maintain the notices in the bathrooms. By allowing the partnership and nonprofits, we believe the implementation cost of the program will be kept at a minimum. The bill gives...
Representative Hansel, I am itching to open the work session so we can move your bill.
You want me to just conclude then?
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions?
I agree.
All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 375, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 375. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Co-Chair Johnson, I move Senate Bill 375 to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion. Is there any question? Are there any questions? Any discussion? Any objection? I should have asked you.
None.
Right answer. All right. So ordered. Senator Hansel will take this to full and to the floor. And do we have to the Senate floor, do we have a volunteer for the House? Representative Meek volunteers on the House side. I am going to close the work session on Senate Bill 375 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 693.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 693 eliminates probationary driver permits, makes changes to the requirements to obtain a hardship permit, and repeals driver license suspensions for several criminal offenses. The Department of Transportation anticipates a reduction in revenue of approximately $220,723 of other funds in the 17-19 biennium from the elimination of probationary driver permits. There is a minimal expenditure impact to the Department of Transportation for changes to the DMV computer system, but once changes have been made, workload is anticipated to decrease from having fewer suspensions. The Judicial Department notes that this measure is expected to result in a reduction of violation, misdemeanor, and felony cases filed in circuit courts for both driving while suspended and driving while revoked. This will have a minimal fiscal impact to the Judicial Department, District Attorneys, and the Public Defense Services Commission.
Thank you very kindly, and... thank you. We have the sign-in sheet here, and I will call up together, Amy Joyce from Department of Transportation and Deanna Mack from the Department of Revenue. And Ms. Joyce was signed up first, so you can bat first. Oh, yes. Before you start, Ms. Joyce, we have some proposed amendments, and I'm going to turn again to the professional staff.
I apologize. Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, just to give you a briefing on what's posted on OLIS, there's a -A3 amendment. This restores the Department of Revenue's ability to suspend or revoke a driver's license or permit for failure to pay taxes. This does not change the fiscal impact. There's also a -A4 amendment, which expands the current exemption for members of the armed forces and their spouses from holding an Oregon driver's license to include the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and their spouses. This amendment also does not change the fiscal impact.
Thank you. With that, Ms. Joyce.
Chair Johnson and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 693 is a bill from Senators Winters, Courtney, and Dembro. Coming at the issue from several different directions. The primary issue is that under current law, Oregon suspends people's driver's licenses for lots of reasons, and some of those reasons have absolutely nothing to do with driving. We suspend people for littering. We suspend people for a number of different things. And so one aspect of this bill is to roll back those suspensions that have nothing to do with driving privileges. The second part of the bill has to do with probationary and hardship permits. And what we have is a system where if your driver's license is revoked, you would think with that word you would never be allowed to drive again, but you can get a probationary permit. If you are suspended, you can get a hardship permit. They're effectively the same thing. So one thing the bill does is get rid of probationary permits, but allow folks to get the hardship permit. And then it streamlines somewhat the hardship permit process, which is under various statutes accumulated over the years. If you're suspended for this kind of thing, you can get a hardship permit to go to alcohol treatment and to go to work, but you can't get it to go to the grocery store. If you're suspended for this other reason, you can go to the grocery store, and it's a bit of a hodgepodge to the point that we have a handful of experts at headquarters at DMV who have to parse out each one of these applications to figure out what you qualify for, whether you qualify, what your requirements are once you get the hardship permit. So 693A aims to streamline those things. So the fiscal on this bill has to do really with the reduction in the number of people who are suspended, which therefore leads to the reduction in the number of people who have to reinstate their license. And you pay a $75 fee to reinstate your license. So there's a reduction there. Same thing for hardship permits. If you no longer need a hardship permit, you're no longer paying the $50 fee to get a hardship permit. So that leads to the projection of the loss of the $200,000 or so dollars over a biennium. I will tell you that in our cost study that I believe this committee has heard about already, those activities probably cost more than the fee that currently is in statute. So in terms of efficiencies, we'll get more efficiency than the loss in revenue.
Colleagues, any questions for Ms. Joyce? I have one. I have a constituent who had a wild and troubled youth, enough so that he ended up with a driving while suspended habitual offender and a felony. Is there any possibility that that fact scenario was contemplated in 693? Because now he cannot possess a driver's license. It has led into a spiral of loss of employment, loss of home, loss of everything.
Yeah. Senator Johnson, we'd have to look at the specific facts of that case to see if there's anything there. I'm also aware that there's a bill that I believe Representative Olson sponsored and that it is making its way through the process that sounds somewhat factually similar to what you're talking about. I'd be happy to work on that offline and see if there's something that can be done for that individual, whether under this bill, Representative Olson's bill, or under current law.
Under current law, I'm afraid he's at a dead end. I've already gone to the district attorney to ask whether or not there's any possibility, and the answer was no. And there had been some work groups formed, and they had failed to touch that lifetime suspension for habitual offender that translated into a felony.
Senator Johnson, it sounds very familiar from Representative Olson's fact situation. That bill was in judiciary and, again, is moving through the process. I'd be happy to take a look at your case.
Thank you very much. We'll take that offline. Welcome, Ms. Mack. Does that conclude your testimony?
It does. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Mack.
For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I'm here for two reasons. One, to talk about the underlying bill briefly so you understand what it does for the Department of Revenue, and then also the A3 amendment. So first, you all know the Department of Revenue does collections for tax and non-tax debt. One of the tools that we have in our non-tax area is a license reinstatement program. So as an awareness for you, as you have the ability to revoke fewer licenses, we have less opportunity to reinstate them. This last year alone, we entered into 4,000 payment plans and received about $1.5 million as a result of that. So just as an awareness issue for us, that does reduce the ability of us to enter into the fewer licenses that are suspended, the less we can reinstate. But we're not opposed to the bill at all, just an awareness, letting you know that that is an outcome of that particular policy choice. The A3 amendment, though, is at our request. We worked with Representative Gomberg on that because in Section 21 of the engrossed version of the bill, it takes away our ability to suspend a license for a commercial driver's license only. So right now, for failure to comply with tax law, if we've tried to exhaust every other collection method, under current law, we can suspend or revoke a occupational license, so nurses, doctors, lawyers, that kind of thing, anyone who has an occupational license who fails to comply and pay their taxes can have that license suspended. This bill, as drafted, would take that, would exclude truckers from that. So they would be exempted from having their license suspended for the same reasons that other people would have their licenses suspended. And so we would ask that the Section 21, and that's what A3 does, is remove Section 21 from the bill to restore our collection tool for those folks. We use this tool very judiciously. It's at the very end. We try to do everything we can to collect the debt from the person before it gets to this point. It's often to the point where the notice of intent to suspend is what gets the money, gets them to pay. We collect several hundred thousand dollars a year using this tool when people, because of the notice of intent to suspend, and generally if we get to a point where we have to suspend a license, it's to prevent more debt from accruing because they're such bad actors. So we just wanted to ask that you restore that collection tool in the bill. It's the A3 amendment. It does treat taxpayers differently as well because it would exclude truckers and not have the same consequence for them. But nurses and doctors who had that same behavior would still have their licenses suspended. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Representative Gomberg first.
Thank you. Excuse me for interrupting, Madam Co-Chair. And thank you, Ms. Mack. I appreciate you bringing this question to my attention because I do have some passing interest in the question of collecting delinquent debt here in Oregon. And just to summarize, currently revenue is allowed to suspend a professional license. The bill before us, 693, among other things, takes that ability away from you, and this amendment would give that ability back to you.
Mr. Co-Chair, it takes our ability away from us for truckers only, but it leaves it for everyone else. And so we wanted to keep that equity so everyone's treated the same way.
So with that background, Co-Chair, my question is this. We're a Ways and Means Committee, and we typically deal with the fiscal aspects of proposals after policy committees have reviewed them. And so we get some direction from time to time that somewhat limits our ability to delve into policy questions. Was this particular aspect of the bill discussed in any detail at the policy committee?
Mr. Co-Chair, I did testify to it in the policy committee, and I asked after the fact if there would be an amendment, and I never got a response. So I don't know what happened at that point. But it moved out of that committee without amendment.
Representative Noble.
Thank you. The question I have is, how many truckers get suspended? How many commercial or licenses get suspended by the Department of Revenue on average annually?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Noble, last year we issued, I believe it was 20, there was 46 notices of intent to suspend and 24 suspensions, and I believe of those there was, I believe it was six that were truckers, and the other licensees were different types of licenses, nurses, and stuff like that.
Okay.
Follow up.
And of those six, how many ended up actually paying their taxes and bringing their accounts current?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Noble, the ones that pay are the ones that are as a result of the notice of intent to suspend, so the threat of it. The people, when they actually get to a point of suspension, is where we're trying to mitigate the loss and stem the loss to the state.
Again.
Follow up?
So do you have a percentage, say, from the notice then? What I'm trying to get at is how effective is it actually at your primary goal of getting the revenue in? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Noble, this is one of our very, very last collection tools. It's a tool of last resort. So we have tried everything else, garnishment. There's really typically not very many assets, and so they pay because they borrow it from a family member or they borrow it some other way to be able to pay us. And they do pay. We do collect several hundred thousand a year out of it, out of what is owed.
Thank you.
I've dealt with exactly the same constituent situation where a trucker calls up and says, how the hell do you think I can pay my tax arrearages if you take away my ability to drive? Well, on the face of it, that makes a certain amount of sense. But why should truckers be different than cosmetologists? Or I think you can suspend medical practitioners, dentists. What is it in this bill that holds truckers out as being special?
And Madam Co-Chair, that's exactly one of our concerns. Is they're not. I mean, the behavior is the same no matter what. And I did talk with Bob Russell, the Oregon Truckers Association, and he said they didn't ask for this, and he's certainly not opposed to the amendment.
Okay. One other question, and this is probably for Ms. Joyce. I'm reading from a letter that came from the Linn County Justice Court, and I need to get the judge, the Honorable Jad Lemhaus, asked to have this bill made part of the, his letter made part of the permanent record, and he calls out his concerns about Section 31 of Senate Bill 693 that will limit the suspension of driver's privileges upon conviction of MIP alcohol or MIP marijuana to those offenses, quote, resulting from the use of a motor vehicle. He goes on to say the importance of a court's ability to suspend the driving privileges, especially for first-time offenders, cannot be overstated. A court has the authority to reinstate the driver privilege after 90 days of suspension have been completed by a first-time offender. Can you comment on that, Ms. Joyce? It seems as though we're giving away in this bill a powerful tool that could change young driver behavior if they're convicted of MIP alcohol or MIP marijuana.
Chair Johnson, I think the discussion that was had was that where that offense is in some way related to driving, that was the preference of the policy committee where this came from, that seemed to have the nexus, and that was appropriate for driver license suspension. Where the MIP had absolutely nothing to do with driving, that was separate and should be kept separate. So that was the prerogative of the policy committee.
Well, I felt honor-bound to make sure that the judge's letter became part of the record. It was sent to me. It was copied, I think, to Mr. Bender, just to make sure it becomes part of the record.
It's posted on OLIS.
Okay, and it's posted on OLIS as well. Okay, we are deeply into policy land here. Representative Gomberg, then Representative Meek.
I'll defer to Representative Meek. Madam Co-Chair, I'd like to speak to the Dash 4s when appropriate.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Frack, I had a question about it. I do have concerns because there is a difference between a driver losing his license because the cosmetologist can get a ride to work and still do her work, but a truck driver can't get a ride to work and not work. So my question is there a payment plan system that I heard mentioned for getting back on arrears? And I just truly, I know that it would be very difficult to get back to work without a driver's license.
Right. And Madam Co-Chair and Representative Meek, this is the provision here is not a personal driver's license. It's only an occupational license. So the cosmetologist's occupational license would be suspended, and they would not be able to do that work, as would the trucker. So it's the same outcome. So it's just cool. We never suspend for tax collection debt. We never suspend a driver's license that gets you to and from the grocery store, just your that traditional privilege that most people have. That is not what this bill does. It's only for occupational licenses.
All encompassed. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. Any other comments with respect to the dash threes? And frankly, colleagues, I think we are going to need to seek guidance from those higher up the food chain than we are. So I would now turn to the dash fours and I recognize Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And with your indulgence, I'll just make my comments from here rather than swing you around to the witness tables. Colleagues, in Oregon, if you're a member of the armed services and you are posted to our fair state, you are not required to get a new driver's license. Neither are members of your family. And it's not uncommon for you to be posted here and then posted someplace else, maybe posted back again. That is the case if you are a member of the armed services. There is, however, a subtle distinction between the armed services of the United States and the uniformed services of the United States. There are five armed services, as we all know, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, the Navy, and the Coast Guard are five armed services. What are the other two uniformed services?
Merchant Marines?
No.
No. Oh, uniform services.
Uniform services. This is going to be a good trivia question
Army
for you at some
Corps
point.
Of Engineers.
They
yes,
are
NOAA.
The they are the Center for Disease Control and NOAA. NOAA, who we proudly lured away from Washington State, and who are now proudly based in Newport, Oregon, and they are part of the uniformed services, and they indeed wear uniforms and work at the and are posted at the behest of the federal government. But the current statute says that we will allow this license flexibility to members of the armed services, but not also to the members of the uniformed services. So what we have brought forward here, having frankly, just learned of this a few days ago, is an amendment that would include NOAA in the flexibility so that those people serving our country who are based here in Oregon will also have the flexibility to not be required to go out and immediately get a new driver's license, nor would their family members.
Ms. Joyce, as a courtesy to DMV, the correct answer is we have no objection.
Okie dokie.
Yes, Senator Johnson, the correct answer is okie dokie. We're good. It has absolutely no impact on DMV or ODOT whatsoever. It's a law enforcement issue, so we're fine.
All right. Thank you very much. Okie dokie, the byword of the day. Colleagues, are there any objections to the NOAA amendment? May we convey the unanimity of the committee to the big co-chairs?
Okay. I'll register an objection to that.
To the NOAA?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think if I can comment on that.
Please.
I think there's a difference between somebody who signs up and says, when the bad guys come with guns, I'm going to run towards the bullets or whatever. And I just don't think that's true of NOAA and CDC people. So, I mean, I appreciate their service or everything, but it's a different class of service. So I'll just register that little objection.
Running towards the Ebola notwithstanding? Okay. All right. Fine. So with that, colleagues, we're going to speak to the big co-chairs about it. And I will do the best we can to try to get guidance from the big co-chairs on the dash three. Any other comments about the dash threes? Okay. Representative Noble, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 693. And Representative Noble, I would be delighted to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 375 relating to roadside rest area information materials on human trafficking to allow you to cast a vote.
Thank you very much.
So let me do that. We are back in work session on 375. How do you vote?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes.
Thank you very much. I will now close the work session and ask that LFO record Representative Noble's vote. With apologies to Senator Hansel for hustling him through his testimony in perhaps an inelegant way, I would ask our professional staff if you have any other guidance for us today.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, nothing further for today. I see you have three more policy bills tomorrow.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Jolivet, thank you for your patience, both of you. This was somewhat of an unorthodox hearing as we try to sort out some of the details. I appreciate everybody's patience and cooperation. And with that, we are adjourned.